This is a teleconference on the subject of pollutant carcinogen exposure reduction education. The teleconference is being coordinated by Cancer Action New York. We have a wide array of presenters on this call. We have some scientists. We have some cancer prevention educators. We have some legislative advocates. And we have some environmental groups that are on the call. Dr. David Carpenter, MD, with the SUNY University at Albany Institute for Health and Environment, is going to be our central performer. He's going to talk for, say, maybe 5-10 minutes. The rest of us are going to go in the order that we're listed in the media advisory, starting with Dr. Steve Gilbert after Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Gilbert is with the Washington Toxics Coalition. He's on the board of directors. Sharon Kaplan with the Cancer Resource Center of the Finger Lakes is the volunteer services director for that organization. She's a cancer prevention educator that deals with discussing with the public this matter of pollutant carcinogen exposure reduction on a daily basis. Elizabeth Henley is a green labeling law advocate from Long Island. And Ananda Lee Tan is with the Global Alliance for Incineration Alternatives. She's the U.S. and Canada coordinator. So, basically, the purpose of this teleconference is to build cancer prevention education stronger and larger in the U.S., in New York State, where there is this matter of cancer burden that is very much in need of being addressed, and the science has produced so many cancer burden-reducing, cancer risk-reducing messages for the general public. And these messages, they're being provided to the public, but not in the extensive kind of way that will really reduce cancer burden to the degree that the science can indeed reduce the cancer burden. So we're hoping to build cancer prevention education larger and stronger by doing this teleconference here. Thanks a lot for joining in, and let's start with Dr. Carpenter.
Well, thank you, Don. I'd like to start by discussing what I think is a very important publication that appeared just 10 years ago. And it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, first author being Paul Lichtenstein. It was an analysis of the TWIN database in Scandinavia. And the title of the paper is Environmental and Hereditable Factors in the Causation of Cancer. What this study did was look at identical and fraternal twins. And the idea was that if cancer is a genetic disease, that identical twins should all get the same cancer. If it's not in a genetic disease, then that wouldn't be the case, identical twins having the same genes. The conclusion of the study was that most cancers were either totally or primarily due to environmental exposures. There were three specific cancers where there was a genetic component. These included prostate, breast, and colon cancer. But even there, the genetic component never exceeded more than 25%. And in fraternal twins, there was slightly greater rates of the same kinds of cancer, but then fraternal twins live in the same environment for the most part. This is a very important observation because I think most people don't realize that almost all cancer comes from some environmental exposures. It's not to say that our genes are unimportant because two people can be exposed to the same contaminant and their genes may result in metabolizing the contaminant differently or make them more vulnerable. But the initiating event is some environmental exposure. Now, as time goes on, we find more and more environmental exposures that cause cancer, and I can't cover all of them except to say that our chemical environment presently, where we have hundreds of thousands of industrial chemicals and chemicals in the products we use all the time, they've escaped from the products into our water supply, into our food, into the air. And therefore, the whole question of how to avoid exposure to some of these things is very complicated. Let me just mention briefly a few of the things that I've been personally involved in, which I think only indicates how difficult this issue is. A lot of work that I've done recently has been focused on contaminants in water, including drinking water, and in fish, because fish live in water. And the whole question of whether it's even safe to eat fish because they're so loaded with the substances that cause cancer. Now, we don't have a good answer for this. There are healthy fats in fish that are supposed to be good for you. They're essential. But the diseases that the healthy fats protect are the same ones that the chemicals in the fish increase risk for. So that's a real problem. We've just published this week a paper based on a study in New York City looking at kidney cancer, and we find that people that live in the vicinity of dry cleaning establishments that use PERC, perchloroethylene, the common dry cleaning fluid, have a greater risk of developing kidney cancer. And that's because this is a volatile organic compound. It's been known to be carcinogenic in occupational exposure, but this is the first time that we've been able, that anyone's been able to show that simply living near a dry cleaner, especially if you're in an apartment building with a dry cleaner's on the first floor, those fumes waft up through the building and increase the risk of kidney cancer. We have another publication where we looked in New York at people living near hazardous waste sites that contain benzene. Benzene is known to be a carcinogen that causes leukemia, and we find that just living near one of these waste sites, if benzene is a major contaminant, there's a higher rate of leukemia. So one factor, in addition to what we eat and what air we breathe, that increases risk of cancer is where we live. Now, this is not politically a popular finding because, obviously, people have to live someplace, and living near a waste site or near a contaminated site or even near a dry cleaner is posing some problems. There's a very interesting article in the magazine GQ in the February issue on what I see as an important emerging issue on cancer, and this is cell phones and brain cancer. There's been relatively little attention to this issue in the U.S. It's gotten huge coverage in Europe, but the evidence that spending a long time on your cell phone increases your risk of brain cancer is getting to be stronger and stronger all the time. Real questions remain. We don't really know a mechanism whereby this non-ionizing radiation causes cancer, and there haven't been good animal results that have documented cancer. But then this is not a chemical. This is a different kind of radiation. And actually just 1 year ago today, I presented some of the evidence to the President's Cancer Panel on this subject. So there are a variety of things that cause cancer. From the point of view of what we can do, I think one of the major things is we have to really take steps to get carcinogens out of our food supply. There are natural carcinogens. We can't do much about that. But there are chemicals that are in our food supply that are a result of how we practice agriculture. It's our recycling of animal fats back into the animals we eat. It's the chemicals that we use to treat, to get rid of the pests and so forth. It's the pesticides we put on our crops. And these are our carcinogens. Thank you.
Dr. Gilbert, would you like to speak next?
Sure. This is Stephen Gilbert. I'm in Seattle, Washington. I'll be representing the Washington Toxics Coalition. I'm a toxicologist. I'm an affiliate professor at the University of Washington, and I run my own nonprofit institute, the Institute for Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders, that runs a website called Toxipedia and some several satellite sites. And our focus is providing scientific information in the context of history, society, and culture and to hopefully affect better policy decisions and more sustainable environment. And we've collaborated with the Washington Toxics Coalition for a number of years. I've been on their board of directors for over 10 years. And the Washington Toxics Coalition works to protect public health and environment by eliminating toxic pollutants, you know, recognizing that pollutants cause cancer as well as other disabilities such as neurodevelopmental disorders. And we advocate for policy, and we try to empower communities. And one of our big efforts is to educate people on how to create a more healthy environment. We believe that everybody has a right to a healthy environment free from pollution, and people should be able to reach and maintain their full potential. We also advocate the precautionary principle that there should be a precautionary approach to regulation and management of chemicals. And we particularly focus on a number of chemicals of concern, including the perfluorinated compounds and Teflon-type compounds, toxic flame retardants and PBDEs. Last year, or 2 years ago rather, we had a bill passed to the Washington State Legislature that banned brominated flame retardants in products, and it's nice to see that the EPA has now moved and has reached an agreement with the last company that was producing any brominated flame retardants. We also work on phthalates and chemicals that in rubber and plastics and softened plastics, and they're in our tubing in hospitals. We've also had a big effort on pesticides, trying to eliminate pesticides from and reduce pesticide use in gardening and agriculture. There's, of course, been a focus on PCBs and DDT, heavy metals, and most recently bisphenol A, where there's an effort right now to have bisphenol A banned from baby bottles. And I'm happy to report that the bill has passed the House and the representatives in the Washington State legislative session. So we're now working with the Senate to get that bill passed through the Washington State. Healthy homes and gardens have been another focus where we try to provide information to the public about reducing exposure, particularly childhood exposures, and recognizing that early exposures like that continue throughout the lifetime as we build up toxic pollutants in our body, and this can lead to cancer-causing. You know, we focus on personal care products, lawn and garden chemicals, indoor pest control products. We also have a focus on art and hobby materials, trying to educate people about reducing use of toxic materials and hobbies and around the home. As David mentioned, healthy foods is a really important part of the effort where we try to work with sustainable agriculture to try to reduce the use of pesticides in agriculture, provide a more sustainable environment. And our healthy foods, we focus primarily at hospitals, trying to move them more toward organic foods and provide an example for people to what they can do to reduce the use of pesticides in foods. And a program on another program is on healthy families, getting kids started with reduced exposure. And as I mentioned, a lot of our focus on kids, so that we need to start early and work with families to reduce exposures and have a green environment, a green home with less toxic products at home. To bring some focus to these events, we've had most recently a report released called Earliest Exposure, where we looked at a biomonitoring study that looked at contaminants in as a child was developing in utero. So we looked at taking blood samples from 9 pregnant women in the area in Washington, California, and Oregon, and looked for chemicals like bisphenol A, phthalates, mercury, a perfluorinated compound, and looked at exposure that started in utero and then what happens over the lifetime. And following up that, a couple years ago, we did a study called Pollution in People, which was a study on adults. We again looked at blood and hair samples and looked for brominated flame retardants, phthalates, lead, arsenic, mercury, perfluorinated compounds, pesticides, PCBs, and DDTs. So our efforts is focused on how do we make people more aware that we are being exposed to these chemicals. We're often exposed to these chemicals without our consent and without our knowledge even, and that we need to have better control over chemical exposures. So that's been our primary effort of reducing pollution in people and providing information to the public and working with the legislature to ban some of these chemicals. We're also in a national effort, work with a coordinated group of states through SAFER, where we're trying to get national regulation passed to reduce chemical exposures. So I'll stop there. If people have more detailed questions, I can answer them later.
Is Sharon Kaplan on the call with the Cancer
Yes,
Resource Center of the Finger Lakes? Great.
Mm-hmm.
You're up, Sharon.
Okay, great. I'm Sharon Kaplan. I work at the Cancer Resource Center of the Finger Lakes. We are a small staff support organization in Ithaca, New York, and we provide information and support for anyone with any type of cancer along with their family, friends, and caregivers. So while our organization is really focused on supporting people who have already been diagnosed with cancer, we saw a need in the community to do some outreach on cancer prevention. So that's where I came into the picture, and with a small startup grant from our United Way agency, we decided to create a program called that we named the Body Care Aware Project, and its goal is to go out and get into do presentations in local area high schools and colleges. So we're really targeting teens and young adults with this project, and the goal is to introduce them to the chemicals that are in their body care products, more specifically makeup, shampoo, deodorant, anything that they actually put on their bodies. The idea behind this is that by the time kids are teenagers, they're already in the marketplace. They're very susceptible to the marketing schemes out there to use this product. They need this product. So they're using a lot of different body care products daily. And one of the first questions we ask them is to take an inventory of how many products they use on their bodies each day. And for the young women, it's usually more than for the young men, but the average is about 12. And we point out to them that they may be using 12 different products, but the combination of chemicals in each of those products, their total chemical exposure could be to over 100 chemicals per day. And then the other eye-opening piece of this for the teens is that we ask them to read the labels on these products, and most of them can't pronounce the ingredients. So we point that out to them, and we say, you can't pronounce it, you don't know what it is, maybe we should look into this and find out what these chemicals are. So we talk a lot about parabens in products, and they're linked to cancer. We talk about 1,4-dioxane, often labeled as sodium lauryl sulfate, and that connection to cancer. We talk about metals and lead, especially in makeup. We talk about phthalates as a component of fragrances, and everything on the marketplace today, almost everything has a fragrance in it. And the fact that these fragrances are proprietary, meaning that the company can just list the ingredient as fragrance and does not need to list the ingredients in that fragrance, which could be volatile compounds and phthalates. So there's a lot of disguise that happens with that label of fragrance, and people really need to know that, and the young people especially need to know the combinations that they're using could have potentially toxic and potentially cancerous outcomes. So what we also teach them is that while these chemicals, you know, scientifically speaking, have been found to, you know, in these small amounts to not have any kind of toxic effect, the combination that they're using, meaning the combination of a paraben in this product and a paraben in that product, will actually reach a toxic level when combined. In addition, a lot of these chemicals, when combined, have formaldehyde as a byproduct, which is another alarming thing. So we've had a very good response in the classrooms, in the health classes, both from the teachers and from the students, to the information that we're presenting. Another component of this presentation and the information that we're giving to young people are that they can make decisions about their body care products. This is one component of their life that they can actually have a choice over. And we encourage them to find products that have the fewest amount of ingredients, and also, going along with that, the most ingredients that they can understand, that are readable, that are understandable, that are basic ingredients to them. We also encourage them to help change policies surrounding dangerous chemicals and body care products on the market. That could be anything from one young woman shared the experience that she had put lipstick. She and her friends had put lipstick on for a Halloween costume. It was a black lipstick, and all of their they found that all at the same time their lips started burning, and they realized that something was wrong with that product. So they all called the company and reported to the company their side effects. And we encouraged a step further, calling the Better Business Bureau, writing an article in the paper, just making sure that that the public knows what's happening, and also that companies understand what's happening with their products. And in addition, to encourage them to call and let them know that they will use their product if they remove the harmful chemicals. Just steps like that. That they can take to encourage this kind of chemical removal from their body care products. So I think that I'll end here. And if there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer about our outreach efforts in the Pacifica area.
Elizabeth, are you on? You know, going to talk with us about the green labeling law?
Yes, hi. I'm joining this conversation to advocate for legislation that will give all of this information to the public and make it more readily available. I don't feel that we just need to know about carcinogens in our environment and food supply, but I think we have the right to know. And California has a law called Proposition 65. The formal title is the Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act of 1986. And in the state of California, products have to be labeled if they are contain an ingredient, a chemical known to cause cancer by the state of California. I also have it right in my possession right now, the 10th report on carcinogens. It's from 2002, but it's put out by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Public Health Service National Toxicology Program. And this is a really extensive volume. It's a big book. It's 270 pages, listing listing chemicals known by the federal government to be carcinogens. And in their introduction in the book, it says that the probability that a resident of the United States will develop cancer at some point in his or her lifetime is 1 in 2 for men and 1 in 3 for women. And this is really, you know, information tells you how you can be exposed to these chemicals. And I think that people will make, intelligent decisions if they go into a marketplace and they have a choice of products, some which are labeled which contains a known carcinogen and the others don't, they're naturally going to pick the safer product. And I don't understand why no one else is advocating for this legislation, because I really think we can't begin to, I mean, from even what all you are saying, all you scientists and experts, we can't begin to reduce cancer until we reduce exposure to the things that cause cancer. And I think we can't get anywhere without giving the people information. And I think we have the right to this information. I think that's all I have to say. But I've been trying over the years to call attention to try to get this type of legislation passed. And I wish all people that are involved in this issue would advocate for it. Thank you.
I think one of our last speakers is Ananda Lee Tan with the Global Alliance for Incineration Alternatives. Is Ananda here on the call?
Hi, I am. Yes, I'm sorry I had to join a bit late. I just got off a separate call on occupational health and safety, but I'm glad to be here. I guess I should just jump in right now, eh?
Yes, just jump right in and introduce yourself. And you've
okay.
Already.
So I'm Ananda. I work with the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. We are a worldwide alliance of community-based groups, public health advocates, various environmental justice activists around the world. We have about over 600 members in over 80 countries around the world, and we came together about 10 years ago when there was a huge rise in the expansion of the waste incineration industry around the world. And as different communities got in touch with each other about their public health concerns, we decided that a good way to deal with this huge proliferation would be to create a network where communities could support each other with information and thereby empowering each other to fight these toxic industries. A bit of background on incinerators and incineration, especially since now we're witnessing here in the U.S. another attempt to expand the waste incineration industry under the umbrella of climate clean energy solutions. What incinerators are is basically big garbage burners where municipal solid waste and other forms of waste are sort of all sort of shoved in, burnt with very little safeguard for emissions and toxic emissions and public health. Incinerators, according to EPA stats, incinerators are one of the leading causes. They used to be the leading cause of dioxins globally and still continue to be one of the leading industrial emitters of dioxins, but not just dioxins, other known carcinogens, heavy metals and other carcinogens. What happens in the process of burning garbage, as you can imagine, is there's all kinds of toxins go into these burners in the first place. The heat actually triggers the creation of new dioxins and furans and other cancer-causing pollutants. I personally am not a sort of a health or a toxins expert myself, so I'll speak more to what we do to address this huge industrial or this pollution threat to communities. The one other thing I should mention here, and I imagine other speakers on this call may have brought up, is the environmental justice aspect of it. Incinerators, even today, actually even more today than 20 years ago, there's a higher likelihood of incinerators being cited in working class people of color communities across the U.S. And that's been a primary concern for members of our network who are already fighting huge toxic waste sites and industries in their backyard. But then when it comes time to deal with the waste issue, various governments end up choosing some of the poorest neighborhoods to put these burners in. So what we do as a network, and as I said earlier, is largely facilitate discussions between communities. There has been a huge, over the last 10 years, we've also seen a lot of communities fight back and push back on these incinerator proposals in their communities, raise public awareness, lobby their local governments, and drive the waste industry to a more sustainable direction. And that's where the good news really lies. In the realm of waste management, you're all probably familiar with the term zero waste. We've had some very big picture thinkers in especially here in California, who've really decades ago sort of envisioned a world without waste, where we would recycle, reuse, reduce the waste that we produce in this society, and as a result, sort of create less toxins, create less public health threats, and generally, sort of create a more sustainable society. Unfortunately, while we saw a lot of progress on that front and through the 90s into this last decade, we haven't seen outside some areas such as California, Northern California, significant growth in terms of zero waste policies and practices. And that's where we work together with communities to communicate that there are safer, more economically beneficial alternatives, such as recycling, where we desperately need jobs, but also can simultaneously reduce these public health threats. And that's where some of our, we work with workers groups, local agencies in raising those awareness. We've recently launched a campaign in collaboration with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the Teamsters Union, who represent about 30,000 waste workers around the country, both truck drivers, but sorters at recycling facilities and transfer stations, to really ensure that any subsidies or incentives provided the waste sector are funneled towards recycling and safe ways of reducing waste. This campaign's just recently launched, so it's currently has really a national policy objective of getting our new administration to which it already has, but really ramp up its efforts to reduce waste, push funding towards recycling and away from destructive waste practices such as not just incinerators, but also landfill gas-to-energy projects, which basically keep us in the cycle of sending garbage to dump sites and burners. And finally, working with workers and communities on the ground to kind of raise their levels of awareness around their exposure and the need to really step up and start raising that awareness in their communities and pushing back on new incinerator proposals. The final piece I should mention in terms of what we do, our website is www.no-burn.org, and we put a lot of resources out there for people to use, easily accessible communications materials, reports on health impacts, toxicology reports, advocacy toolkits, toolkits that help communities. Oftentimes, who some of these most impacted communities, like I mentioned earlier, have very few advocacy groups or public interest groups that they can access in their backyard. So what I do on a daily basis is field calls and then introduce people to either veteran activists in their region or public health experts. We have a number in our network. We're a very committed bunch of health practitioners and people who've been dealing with public health issues for decades who will travel to communities to help them raise their awareness and provide them organizing tools and all throughout the U.S. and Canada. And so by empowering our network and facilitating this conversation, we find that the best way to help people and our, the nation at large push back against this toxic industry sector is to get them to help each other. I'll end with that, and our Recycling Works campaign website is www.recyclingworkscampaign.org.
Is there anyone else, any other participant that wants to make a presentation? Yeah, if not, I'll make my presentation, then we'll get on to the media. Anybody else that wants to make a presentation?
No, I just wanted to know whether the transcript of this conference call will be available.
Certainly will. Okay, I'm Don Hussig. Our organization is Cancer Action New York. Our work has largely focused on reducing exposure to dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. The very powerful information that we've been making use of has largely been put in the draft US EPA dioxin reassessment. It's still in draft. The dioxin reassessment was submitted to the National Academy of Sciences several years ago. NAS looked at the document, got back with EPA, has directed EPA to make some changes in the dioxin reassessment that would focus on better describing the uncertainties that exist within the dioxin reassessment, especially with regards to the use of toxicological equivalent factors to, estimate and make some kind of quantification of the total amount of dioxin exposure, and also to deal with a little more kind of clarity on the cancer risk assessment that is contained in Part 3 of the dioxin reassessment. We feel that it is unacceptable for US EPA to have taken so very, very long in producing this dioxin reassessment. If the dioxin reassessment were to be finalized, that would provide a considerable amount of public awareness around the dioxin exposure cancer risk issue. Dioxin is one of the groups of chemical compounds which has been very extensively studied to the point where cancer risk quantification has been done. There are lots of chemicals are known to cause cancer. Lots of exposure agents are known to cause cancer. But as far as how much risk is being imposed by a certain amount of exposure, that is only known for a limited number of chemicals, and it's known for dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. Combining that fact with the fact that everyone that eats animal fat foods is exposed on a regular basis to dioxins and dioxin-like compounds, it's very reasonable to push for reduced dioxin exposure, and basically the way to accomplish that is to have these powerful educational tools such as the dioxin reassessment, the US EPA dioxin reassessment, made final and presented to the public, and public hearings around this and all the, you know, the activities that surround something of this magnitude. In 2003, the Institute of Medicine published a very powerful report about dioxins. It's titled Dioxins and Dioxin-like Compounds in the Food Supply, Strategies to Decrease Exposure. The ringing call from this particular document was that women of childbearing age and girls should reduce their dioxin exposure by reducing their consumption of animal fat-containing foods. This recommendation was largely made due only to the endocrine disrupting effect of dioxin exposure. It did not really, the cancer risk that is imposed by dioxin exposure is in addition to this endocrine disrupting effect, even though there are certain, you know, overlapping aspects of this. But the point is that if the Institute of Medicine is recommending back in 2003 to reduce dioxin exposure and reduce consumption of animal fat to accomplish that, based mainly on the endocrine disrupting effect, the combination of the endocrine disrupting effect and the cancer risk that is imposed is a very, very powerful reason for reducing exposure, not only for girls and women, but for all people who consume animal fat foods and are exposed to dioxins and are placed at increased cancer risk by so doing. A paper that I'd really like to really focus on as well, it's been included in the dioxin reassessment. It's where a large part of Part 3, the cancer risk characterization, came from. This paper is titled Quantitative Cancer Risk Assessment for Dioxins Using an Occupational Cohort. The lead author is Heiko Becker. And this paper describes this mathematical method, this mathematical exercise of determining how much cancer is caused by dioxin exposure. They looked at an occupational cohort. It was German factory workers who were exposed to dioxins, which were a contaminant of pesticide manufacturing industry. They broke the amount of exposure down into groups of high exposed, low exposed, medium exposed, based on length of occupational exposure and the part of the industry they were working in. They found that for all cancers combined, there was an increased cancer risk with the increased dioxin exposure. They found no threshold effect. The cancer risk was imposed regardless of how much exposure took place. A certain amount of cancer risk was imposed. They quantified the amount of cancer risk imposed based upon, you know, how much exposure was taking place. And US EPA looked at that study and several other studies, a few other studies, the Ranchette study, and I think there was one other occupational cohort they looked at. They came up with a cancer risk slope factor of 1 in 1,000. If you do the simple arithmetic, which can be done once you've come to the point of having this cancer risk slope factor, which is not simple arithmetic, but it's mathematics that people who are mathematicians can well understand and consider to be relevant to this matter, the amount of cancer risk imposed by the average amount of consumption of animal fats contaminated with dioxins in the U.S. totals to 308,000 Americans every 70 years getting cancer because of their dioxin exposure alone. And when one considers the fact that when we consume animal fat, we're not only consuming dioxins, which are known to cause cancer, we're also consuming PCBs, some of them which are not dioxin-like, which cause cancer. We are consuming pesticides, which cause cancer. We are consuming the PBDEs, which have been shown to cause cancer in animals. There's really a long list of these pollutant carcinogens in animal fat, and it wouldn't be all that, we're hoping for science to, hold the day here, to have the main determining result in all of this as far as reducing cancer burden. We're hoping that government will join in and start being a far better partner in what we've been talking about today, this cancer prevention education that involves reduced exposure to pollutant carcinogens. They have a role in this. The people look to government as a protector of public health. We're hoping that state health departments will begin to consider producing health hazard advisories for animal fat consumption, similar to what the state of California does on diesel exhaust occupational exposure. There's a considerable cancer risk, a 1 in 1,000 excess cancer risk, a considerable amount of cancer risk imposed by the dioxin content alone. If we were to see finally a cancer risk assessment for all of the pollutant carcinogen exposures that take place by consumption of animal fat, it'd be certainly far greater than 1 in 1,000. So I will end here But the point is that we need governments to join in. It's a huge job to use the science that exists right now to prevent as much cancer as possible. Demands that government start taking its part in educating about reducing exposure to pollutant carcinogens. Okay, media, here you go. It's your turn. Do we have any questions for the media? Is Jeff Myers with the Plattsburgh Press Republican still on the call?
Yeah, I'm here. I want to kind of go over some of this information here before I ask any major questions.
Don?
I know how to get a hold of you, Don, if I can call you back. But, David, could I give you a call at some time to go over?
Of course, anytime.
Okay.
Is there any one big question you could give us for our radio program that we're doing with this? What's your big question that you have in your mind before, we leave here?
Me?
Yeah, do you have one main question here for us?
The one thing that kind of kept popping into my head here, when somebody had mentioned the idea, not of dioxins, but something that people are a lot more familiar with in the use of cell phones, and I think a lot of people hear about that, but you don't really see much concern from it. Is it that people are so into their cell phones and their McDonald's and so on and so forth that they don't want to hear about this?
Well, I think the evidence is not as strong for the hazard there as it is with some other things yet, but the evidence is getting stronger all the time,
uh-huh.
And it is true that nobody wants to hear about it. It's also true that the telecommunications industry, at least in the U.S., has really clamped down on the information available. The Federal Communications Act of the late 90s actually prohibits communities from arguing about the placement of cell phone towers based on health effects. This was a law passed by our Congress, and that's just outrageous. The concern is growing because the recent studies from Scandinavia now show that a teenager that begins to use a cell phone is a 5 times greater risk of developing a brain tumor than if an adult starts to use a cell phone. And every kid everywhere is on the cell phone all the time.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of reason to think that this is going to be the docs and the tobacco smoke problem of the future. But the evidence is not all there. But on the other hand, there's sufficient evidence right now that precaution would tell us that we need to inform the public of this hazard.
I think the critical thing, this is Steve Gilbert, the critical thing you mentioned there, David, is the change in exposure. I think as exposure is occurring at younger ages for longer periods of time.
Absolutely right, yes. And of course we have Wi-Fi almost everywhere. Certainly Starbucks and McDonald's are Wi-Fi environments. Cell phone towers are appearing everywhere. Studies from Austria now are showing that for the average person, about 40% of their total exposure to radio frequency radiation comes from the cell phone towers. It's even more significant on an average level than using the cell phone. And then one can't do anything about that if you live near a tower.
And in relation also to me, that we're a nation that loves our burgers and all, do you see that as well, that the government really kind of wants to protect the meat industry?
Well, yes. I was on that IOM panel that Don was mentioning on dioxin-like compounds in the food supply. And that panel had all the representatives from the beef industry, the pork industry, and the poultry industry. And, they were arguing, well, what are we going to do with all this waste fat? So you feed it back to the animals that are not normally carnivorous, and they grow faster. And otherwise you'd have to get rid of all this waste fat. So they're really this recycling of contaminant-laden animal fat back into the animals we eat is outrageous. The whole business of fish, the oceans are contaminated now, so fish oil is contaminated. The biggest use to fish oil in the U.S. is feeding it to chickens. And so we're taking these contaminants that have polluted the ocean and we're putting them into the land animals that are, you know, again, as I say, they're not normally carnivorous, and this bioconcentrates these contaminants that we know to be carcinogens and have a whole host of other non-cancer adverse health effects. We have not had any government movement that would reduce this recycling of waste fats.
So that would make a difference, that we could continue to consume meat products that would be more safer if we got rid of this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The contaminants primarily come from the recycling. I mean, we've stopped through the Clean Air Act. We've reduced the emissions of dioxin enormously. Now, Don mentioned that. Now the biggest source of dioxins is backyard burn barrels, rural people that burn their trash, especially their plastic, in the backyard. But we've dramatically reduced the emissions of dioxin, but we're still recycling all the stuff that was released 20, 30 years ago in this waste animal fat.
I think this is Steve. I think we also need to step back a little further and look at how the farm subsidies have made the burger a lot cheaper than it should be, and it's not a good use of protein and anything to make burgers for mass consumption at such cheap prices they are at.
Yeah, it certainly has adverse health effects beyond just the contaminants.
Absolutely. I mean, all the corn syrup, I mean, there's a whole lot of things that go into our agriculture subsidy program that distorts the food we eat.
Well, I think it sounds like we're closing in on, you know, being done with this. Thanks a lot for joining in. I'm sure that cancer prevention education grew a little stronger and a little larger due to our, you know, our good efforts here. And I'm very hopeful about where this is going to go in the future. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck. Yeah, good luck with all your work.